Hi, I'm Candace Michelle, and you're listening to Our Community. You know, over the years, I've had the pleasure of interviewing scores of people who've made a big difference in their communities. And I'm always impressed by the tenacity and diligence that it takes to get things done, and the heart to care. But there are few things that are as critical to our future as the welfare of our children. And my guest today is a strong advocate for that. She's the executive director of Wally's House, a child abuse intervention center that has just recently achieved its nonprofit status. Jacqueline Antunes, welcome to the show, Jackie.
Thank you.
That's a beautiful name, Jacqueline. Is that the way you pronounce it, Jacqueline?
Yes.
It's just beautiful, and I don't think I've ever seen it spelled that way.
No, my mom got creative.
I love that. I just love it. Creative parents, you know? So, Jackie, you did an interview with Connie Hunter for KCIW back, I think it was like 2016, maybe. And I listened to that interview again last night, and I was struck by what a wonderful interview you guys did. It was great and very informative. And we're going to talk about Wally's House in a few minutes, but I'd like to kind of get to know you a little bit, because I have no clue. Like, you know, where were you born? Where'd you grow up? You know, what kind of things, what things shaped you and made you who you are?
I could probably take up an hour just talking about me.
But, that'd be great.
But I won't. I'll try and make it short, sweet, concise. I was born in Kenora, Saskatchewan.
Wait a minute, Saskatchewan, that's Canada.
That's correct.
Whoa, okay.
My father was a Canadian citizen, didn't move. He came to the U.S. with a friend of his. His friend was visiting his fiance in Portland. She was in nursing school. And there was this delightful brunette with blue eyes that he met that night. And they very quickly decided that they were meant for each other. And they married quickly. And then she moved to the Canadian prairie with him in Saskatchewan, and that's where I was born.
Do you remember that? Do you remember Saskatchewan?
We visited there as I was a child, when I was older. I've traveled through there as a teen and as a young adult. However, I don't remember living there. My mother left Canada when I was 18 months old, and then my parents got back together when I was three, and they lived in Portland, where all three of my younger brothers were born. And we moved to British Columbia when I was in fourth grade. And
British Columbia is gorgeous.
Oh, it is. It's very beautiful.
And where were you in British Columbia?
So we were in the Okanagan Valley. We lived in Winfield, which is north of Kelowna, and a little bit south of Vernon. My parents had a grape vineyard. And my dad had his own excavating business. So most of the work that he did was in building things in Rutland, Kelowna, Penticton, Vernon, Winfield. He did a lot of septic lines, all kinds of digging for construction sites, lots of pools. And then my dad and his wife later in life, when he sold his business and he retired, they moved to Dunalda, Alberta. So he moved. Most of people in Canada, their dream is to retire from the prairies to British Columbia, where it's nice. And
He wanted to go back to the prairie.
He loved farming.
He
went back to that. And they also went back to be a support to her parents who were aging. That's that part of the story. We moved, my mother and my brothers and I moved to Gold Beach when I was in seventh grade.
You're kidding.
No.
You've been in Gold Beach most of your life.
I left when I was a sophomore in high school and went to a boarding academy over in the valley. I went to Milo Adventist Academy and graduated there in 82. It was funny, my mom, I wanted to come home and stay a year between college and boarding school. And my mom said, you've got your financial aid in line. You've been accepted to college. You need to go. I don't want to see you married to a logger or a fisherman.
Yes, yes.
Not that there's anything bad with them, but she wanted to allow me to see the world. So
yes.
It was out the door, and I took a road trip with a girl I'd never met before who'd graduated 3 years before me from Milo, and we went down to Keene, Texas, and I started my college education down there at what's now called Southwestern Adventist University.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, it was still a college.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where I did
wow.
attend college. And
you've had a very interesting...
I've done quite a few things. It
yeah.
was in Texas that I got involved in working in residential treatment for emotionally disturbed and abused children. So I worked in three different models.
Mm-hmm.
Several different facilities. One model the first type of residential care that I did for children was called Odyssey Harbor. And the woman that founded and built that program wanted to take the worst of the worst in her view or in
mm-hmm.
the view of those who were dealing with children
mm-hmm.
at that time. In Texas at that time, they were putting children in residential care from all forms of custody. So you could have a child who had mental health issues placed with a dependent child and also with children who were from county juvenile departments or the Texas Youth Commission,
mm-hmm.
TYC. We in Oregon have separated that out. They separated that out in the, I'm going to say, late 80s. If I remember correctly,
mm-hmm.
so that your criminal children were not with your dependent children, because what would happen in those residential placements everywhere that you were mixing your mentally ill, your dependent, and your criminal children was abuse was happening to the more vulnerable children.
Yeah, of course.
It's
not a good mix.
No, and so they learned that through mm-hmm. trial and error in
right.
everywhere. So now... They do a better job of placing children in residential care. But that model that I first worked in was what they called they called us a group counselor.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was almost like a camp. So they had dorms for the boys and girls initially, and they would assign you 4 to 5 children that you would take from one activity to the next.
Okay.
And I went from being a group counselor to a medical supervisor. And so I worked under the doctor's license, taking the kids to doctor's appointments, eye appointments, administering medications and filling prescriptions and that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
We had a physician who was married to the director who'd founded it. It was the Vargas. And he was a neurologist and a psychiatrist, if I remember. So
wow.
I think he was Hungarian.
Mm-hmm.
So little tiny man with a thick accent. And that was a very, very educational time for me. I went from that program to one in Fort Worth called Lena Pope Home. And the model that they used was a teaching family model. So they would have a couple in a house with about 6 to 8 youth. And the people who worked with those kids had to go through a 40-hour training in that teaching family model, or sometimes it's called family teaching model, which was founded in Boys Town. And you work with a child on a point economy. And those children
okay.
then learn how to self-correct their behavior
right.
through the teaching interactions.
Right.
You had a point card. And the child earned positive and negative points. The
mm-hmm.
whole point of that was to place the responsibility of the child's behavior and rewards on the child.
Right.
You never, in your interaction with the child, said, well, you're being disruptive, so I'm taking this privilege. It
mm-hmm.
was always, boy, Johnny, I'm really sorry that you're having a rough day, but you're cussing mm-hmm. and swearing and stomping
mm-hmm.
around the kitchen. So for being disruptive and using foul language, you've earned a negative 1,500 points.
Mm-hmm.
And so that child would then have to take up their point card, accept the point fine. And then you went right into a teaching interaction
mm-hmm.
with that child where,
mm-hmm.
because they've accepted their point fine, they've earned positive points because they've given you eye contact, they've
right.
earned positive points. By the time you finish that whole teaching interaction, that child has earned back a good portion of those points. So they never feel buried in that,
right.
And they're learning what right. the appropriate behavior and action is.
Right.
And I worked at Lena Pope Home in their independent living program with that model. The children that were in that part of the program were in an apartment complex, and they were ages 16 through, we had some 19-year-olds even, and they were kids who were, again, placed there through county, they were dependents as far as foster children, or they were in the juvenile system, and so they were learning how to apply for jobs, interview, how to, fill out resumes, all of that, and then how to buy groceries. I mean, we'd take them on shopping trips, and they bought their own groceries, they cooked
That's
their own meals,
excellent.
And we just went into the apartment throughout the shift and just checked on them, or we transported them to and from work or interviews. Mm-hmm. My other place that I worked was called Boys Haven. That was down in Beaumont, and that model was a house parent model. So we had room for 12 boys in that household, and I was able to, I did what they call treatment plans there. So we wrote out their goals and everything. There was a counselor on site. We worked with the schools with these kids, and they had a different economy. It was kind of a merit economy, and they had chores. You taught them some more, living skills, but it was not as structured as the Lena Pope Home, or later I went to Midland to Odyssey. That one was High Sky Children's Ranch. And that also used the teaching family model. And in that one, our house we had 8 girls in that house that we worked with. And it was fun. It was lots of different models, lots of different ways
lots
to deal with
experiences.
Kids.
Yeah. Exactly.
And my whole reason for getting into doing residential care was, as a child growing up, there was physical abuse in our home.
Oh.
And
I'm so sorry.
A lot of us have stories.
I know.
I'm not going
Almost
to go into
all of us have
we
stories.
We all have stories.
Yes.
That, we have a lot of walking wounded in our society.
Oh, yeah.
But the whole reason I got into working in residential care at the time was I had, as a teenager, heard, well, if you're an abused child, you will possibly be an abuser.
Right.
And I wanted to stop the cycle.
Mm-hmm.
I read books like Dibs in Search of Self, A Circle of Children, just a lot of books about children that had suffered abuse and the people who'd worked with them. And some of these children had very severe problems.
Right.
I wanted to be a different parent. And I figured if I could learn how to deal with children who had severe issues and get tools, then when the time came for me to be a parent, if that opportunity presented itself, I could do that.
I think it's really interesting because I think a lot of people go into a field to help because they've had an experience in that field as their own personal experience or a sibling's experience or something, and they are just motivated to want to help. And it's probably the best way, right? Because you've really got a personal motivation then.
I think so.
Yeah.
I think if we go into it, though, I think that there are people who get into it because they've had a horrible experience and they want to make a difference, but they don't work at healing themselves.
Yeah.
And so they can
right.
not be as effective as they right. had intended.
Well, congratulations for having the courage to want to work on yourself.
Thank you.
Because it really does take a courage to do that. So,
well, I have to admit, I wasn't the perfect parent. I don't think we ever get to be. But
which one of us?
I think that my kids came out pretty good.
Exactly.
They don't have any visible ticks
exactly.
or twitches. So.
So how did you get back to Gold Beach?
When I was at Odyssey Harbor, I met and married my first husband. We went through the different programs as a couple. And then about 4 years into the marriage, it was very apparent it wasn't going to work. And I left Texas, left my last job, which was in the Midland job at High Sky, and moved back to Gold Beach and wasn't sure what I was going to do, where I was going to go. Mm-hmm. And I ran into someone that I had gone to school with while in Gold Beach in eighth and ninth grade. We hadn't been friends. However, we had been assigned to be eighth grade marching partners at eighth grade graduation.
Aww.
So ran into each other through my brother saying, hey. Mm-hmm. And the rest is history. I mean, we just hit it off. And this year we will celebrate 28 years of marriage.
No kidding. Congratulations.
Yeah.
That's significant.
It's
it's a long time.
It is a long time, and yet it feels like yesterday.
It's
nice to have that, to really have that best friend and that person mm-hmm. that is still just makes your heart go pity pat.
His name's Tony, isn't it?
Correct.
And doesn't he run a restaurant in Gold Beach?
He does. He does.
Oh, he still does. Okay.
He still does. In fact,
Porthole? Is it the Porthole?
Yes.
Okay. I'm bringing that from information I had many years ago.
When we first got together, however, he was a logger for Erickson Air Crane.
No kidding. So your mother said.
I know, but that's what happened. So we actually traveled all over five states during his career on and off. We went from Washington, Oregon, Idaho, California, Nevada mm-hmm. for mm-hmm. what he did with Erickson. They no longer log. They only do the heavy lift, but that was an interesting field. We changed our front yard every few months. Kept the same house. We lived in a fifth wheel.
Oh, got it. I'm thinking, what? That's great, though.
Yeah.
Oh, you saw so many things
yes.
in so many places. What a delight.
It was really, really good. I think it's mm-hmm. what really solidified our marriage yep. because we only had each other to rely on. We had yep. a great crew that was like family.
Right.
But, I mean, if anything came up, he was all I had, and
yep.
I was all he had. And by the time we did move back to Gold Beach mm-hmm. for him to go into business with his mother mm-hmm. and go into the new location in mm-hmm. the Cannery Building, he was actually still working for Erickson. So he'd work during the day on a job where he was project manager for them in Gold Beach.
Mm-hmm.
It was up part of the job. You had to go up Hunter Creek, and part of it you had to go up the Rogue River, either
right.
for getting the trucks in and out
right.
for the trees. But then he'd work weekends and evenings on the new location.
Good grief.
And so he worked with his mother until she passed away in 2007. And now he runs it. Our children have worked with and
excellent
for him.
Excellent food. I mean, it's just excellent food.
I'll pass that on.
When I'm in Gold Beach, that's where I want to eat.
Fish and chips, chowder, pie.
Yamola. Yes. So tell me about how you got into the position that you're in now. You worked with the sheriff's department for a while, or the district attorneys. What was that? How did that all happen?
Well, let's see. So the children were pretty young when we moved here, and I needed to find something to do.
Mm-hmm.
And with him running the restaurant, we weren't going to have insurance,
mm-hmm.
health insurance. So I looked around for jobs that mm-hmm. I felt I was capable of doing. And based on my experience, I fit really well with the juvenile department.
Mm-hmm.
So I worked for them for a short time, and in their early intervention piece that they had through a grant. And then that lasted a short while. And then I went to work for Riley Creek School
mm-hmm.
as their timeout detention room person.
Mm.
Eventually got the title of behavior specialist. And I did that for 3 years. Created the room economy similar to what I'd done at High Sky and at Lena Pope Home. Only I used minutes for the basing how long they would stay
right.
there instead of the
right.
negative and positive points.
Right.
And I had a lot of support from the
nice.
Administration within that building. It was a good job.
Mm-hmm.
But after 3 years I wanted a change and was going to go back to school. And then the juvenile department had another opening. So I went back, applied for that, got the job, and I worked there another 6 years.
Wow. Okay.
Until things got financially to the point where they were having to make cuts.
Mm-hmm.
And then I left there.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't work for a few years. I got to stay home. I actually did some infant child care for my younger sister.
Mm-hmm.
So she could stay, go back to work after her first child was born. And I was working at Corner Drug as a pharmacy tech when this job with the county came open, and they wanted somebody to do forensic interviewing. And I looked at it, and there was like coordinating MDT, which is the multidisciplinary team.
Mm-hmm.
And that consists of law enforcement, DA's office, schools, social services in the way of Department of Human Services, Child Welfare, and Mental Health Services, and then Public Health. So there's a whole team that works on cases in our county and in counties around the state and even around the country that concentrate on cases that are current in dealing with child abuse. I didn't know if I would qualify or not. I interviewed with the DA because at that point they had tucked those services under the district attorney's office.
Mm-hmm.
And so I worked under the district attorney's supervision from January of 2014 until June 30th of 2019.
And what happened then?
Well, I'm going to back up to 2014. Mm-hmm. Even before that, I have been a soroptimist in Gold Beach.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to know Jerry Honeycutt extremely well. She mentored me in being in the treasurer for our club and just in other areas. She's a very nurturing, she's got a background in education, and so she's always willing to mentor and inform and help young women understand what it is in how to be a professional in all kinds of ways. So I was acquainted and friends with her husband Wally as well.
Mm-hmm.
And
Wally.
Yes. So I believe it was August of 2014 that Wally passed away.
Mm-hmm.
And then October of 2014, she and I were on our way to a soroptimist event, and she was talking about wanting to purchase a property and do a couple of things. And one of the things she was considering was creating a child abuse intervention center.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, we could call it Wally's House.
Oh,
and
I love
she
that.
Followed through with purchasing the property in December.
Wow.
By March, she had a contractor and crew in it, working to remodel it specifically to our specifications. The very first person who'd ever done child forensic interviewing for our county was Barbara Eels. I walked her through the building with Jerry, and she helped me lay out how we should have things in that particular building for our interview room and for the observation room. And by October of 2015, we had moved into it with Jerry having an agreement with the county that we would rent the building from her for $1 a month.
Oh.
She said she was willing to create this building for the purposes of a child abuse intervention center, with the caveat that I would create a nonprofit and build it to sustainability so she could donate the building to the nonprofit.
That's wonderful. That's great.
So we are still in the process of that building eventually transferring to the nonprofit. She would like to do it sooner than later, and I feel that, and I know she feels that we have reached that. There, you know, there's just the snafus of inspections
of
and this, that, and the other.
Yeah.
But we have, as of June 30th of 2019, peeled away from the county all of the responsibilities, financial and keeping records and, mm-hmm. and running the program have transferred completely to the nonprofit.
Excellent.
The board was created and started probably, if I remember right, it was our first little gathering was February of 2015. And by, I'm not going to remember the date, but in 2016, we achieved our nonprofit status. So I worked partly for the nonprofit and partly for the county. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And now I completely work for the nonprofit as of the 30th of June.
I'm going to just remind our listeners who they're listening to, just in case they missed the first part of this. You're listening to KCIWLP 100.7 on your FM dial, and this is Our Community. I'm Candace Michelle, and I'm speaking with Jacqueline Antunes today, who is the executive director of Wally's House. And I just found out how Wally's House got its name, which was a real puzzle to me. I really wanted to know how that got its name. So, Jackie, can you tell me what a children's abuse intervention center is?
So a child abuse intervention center, or child advocacy center, as it's better known, is a place where children go when there's allegations of abuse for an assessment. In Curry County, we are still building the full assessment process. So we receive our referrals from law enforcement and Department of Human Services per statute.
Okay.
And we conduct a forensic interview there. We also have a medical room, and we conduct what is called a Carley's Law exam.
And what is that?
So Carley's Law was created in about 1997 because a little girl in Linn County, Carly Sheehan, was murdered by abuse by her mother's boyfriend. Mm. Carly had missing hair, in clumps of hair. She had bruises. She had burns. She was at different times, and nobody caught it. So if a child nowadays presents with burns, bruises, and there's no explanation for it, mm-hmm. or if somebody sees marks.
The explanation sounds pretty weird.
So what happens is we actually have a physician in our county, Dr. Harris, that he's a pediatrician, and he's been trained to diagnose abuse. We mm-hmm. also have someone who's retired in our county that did it before him, and that was Patty Savage. Mm-hmm. She was a pediatric nurse practitioner. But you have to undergo training. We have some other practitioners that are looking at the training so that we can have more people to look at that when Dr. Harris is unavailable. Right now, he will see the kids at his offices Monday through Wednesday for our partners because he does have a practice. Mm-hmm. He's semi-retired.
Right.
If it's a Thursday or Friday, he'll drive up to the center and we'll do them there. Mm-hmm. We also have a physician's assistant, like I said, with another practitioner. Mm-hmm. He's looking at taking the training. There's online training, plus there are fellowships through Northwest Cares in Portland. That is another child advocacy center in our state, and they work with several hospitals and several counties in that area. And so they can train physicians. Carley's Law is required by law if, like I said, if a child has injuries, and the only people that can do those exams are a medical doctor, MD, mm-hmm. a DO, physician's assistant, PA, or a nurse practitioner.
Okay.
So if our practitioners are unavailable that we work with directly, the children are seen in the emergency room or mm-hmm. even by their primary care physician.
Right.
But it has to be someone with those credentials.
And then you get a referral from them? Is that the way it... walk me through a scenario.
So we might get a call and say, hey, we've got a child that needs a Carley's Law exam. So depending on the day, the child is seen, that there's already been a referral made to law enforcement or child welfare regarding these injuries.
That's like the first step.
That is the first step. Okay. So law enforcement or DHS get the referral, and mm-hmm. they cross-report to
okay.
each other.
Right.
And we also, when we get the call, it's like, have you called? Do you want us to call law enforcement mm-hmm. or vice versa?
Right.
And we work with them to arrange where the child will be seen.
Mm-hmm.
And then if the child is not seen by Dr. Harris, our designated medical professional, whoever does that exam has to send their exam results to him for his review.
Okay.
So that's part of our multidisciplinary team mm-hmm. protocols.
Yep.
And then sometimes we also do the forensic interview. But you either do it before or after, depending on how things are with the child's parent, whether the parent is protective, whether the child's already in Department of Human Services custody. There's all
kinds. What is a forensic interview?
So a forensic interview is an interview that's done with the child at the center in a room that is not, the whole building is not intimidating and child-friendly, but the room, there's not a lot of distractions, and it's only the forensic interviewer and the child, and it is video recorded mm-hmm. with law enforcement and or Department of Human Services and or the DA observing that interview, depending mm-hmm. on whether it's a criminal case and there's been a crime committed that looks like law enforcement needs to write a report on, or whether it's an abuse case where DHS has to take custody of the child and work with mm-hmm. the parents on trying to reunify that family.
Mm-hmm.
So back in the 80s, when child abuse really started to be something that we were addressing, someone would report a child's injury or a child would make a disclosure of abuse or sexual abuse. And from there, the child would either go to the doctor would question them, the child would then law enforcement, if law enforcement was involved, they would be interviewed at the police department by law enforcement. They could be interviewed by DHS at the school or somewhere else. Maybe the school counselor interviewed them. So we were getting multiple interviews and multiple versions of the story, and the child was being re-traumatized each time that interview happened. So the whole point of our country and our state creating child advocacy centers is the scenario and the most ideal and best practices to have all of those services and done under one roof. So some centers even have mental health therapists, and that would be ideal for us to be able to do down the road as well. So we have under the roof at Wally's house, we have the medical room. We have myself as the interviewer. We also have four other community partners with the different agencies who have forensic interviewer training.
Great.
They conduct forensic interviews if I'm unavailable or I have a conflict of interest mm-hmm. with a case. And we go through periodic peer reviews. So our regional CAC, which is Jackson County CAC, has a what they call their program manager. And she is a forensic interviewer and a forensic interview trainer. So she's part of the Oregon Child Forensic Interview Team, and she teaches.
She teaches.
She
others.
Teaches.
Yeah, that's
so she
great.
Comes over here, and we sit down as a team and review our interviews and mm-hmm. review how an interview could have how it was done well mm-hmm. and what could be done the next time in a different mm-hmm. interview with another child. So mm-hmm. we are always continuing that. We also, within our county, send professionals to Portland every year to the Clackamas County Child Abuse and Family Violence Summit. So we'll be sending a group again this year in April. So we're always getting trained.
Very difficult work. I just can't imagine. I mean, it would feel bad to talk to a child who'd been abused. It would feel bad for me, but, you know.
It can. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have to take care of yourself. Mm-hmm. The big thing in the human services field and in law enforcement field is making sure you're doing appropriate self-care, mm-hmm. trying not to take those cases home with you. Mm-hmm. Tony asked me, what do you consider a successful interview? Mm-hmm. Is it when you get a disclosure from a child? What is it? And I said, if I can build a connection with a child and they can just talk to me about anything, if there's no disclosure, but that child has connected, that's a successful interview. Yeah. The whole forensic interview process starts with building rapport with the child, mm-hmm. Showing them how, in the way that you question them, how a narrative to talk back to you in a narrative form, mm-hmm. and then, you know, making sure that your questions are open-ended and non-leading. That mm-hmm. was the problem also in the 80s, is we had several times and cases where historically children later said, no, that it didn't happen. Most of the time, when a child tells you something happened, you can be sure that it happened. And we're learning more and more that a very high percentage of the cases, abuse has happened.
Right.
And you believe a child. Yeah. The children back during those times had people feeding them information, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. so they were taught, they were regurgitating and talking about right. things that, because of the way they were questioned,
right.
they were saying things that happened that really didn't.
So open-ended questions mm-hmm. allow the child to tell the story in their own words. Mm-hmm. And
exactly. So it is all about getting the child mm-hmm. to put their story in a narrative form, mm-hmm. and then going back to the maybe a statement that the child's made and say, you said thus and such, tell me about that. Mm-hmm. And then you open it up for them to tell you about that.
Right.
And just going back again, oh, and you said this after, you know, when, mm-hmm. when I asked you that last question, tell me more about that. Mm-hmm. And you can offer them options like, was it this, this, or something else? Mm-hmm. And they can, so right. you're never putting words in their mouth.
Right. And how young, like what are the ages that you typically are seeing?
Anywhere. We see toddlers mm-hmm. for our Carly's Law exams, mm-hmm. and we interview all the way up to age 17. Mm-hmm. Some centers in our state will do interviews of adults who have a diagnosis of some form of disability, mm-hmm. and they are still very childlike in mm-hmm. their mannerisms. Those cases very seldom come to our centers, mm-hmm. but occasionally in a center, those types of interviews have been done.
And what's your sense about Curry County? How are we here? Are we worse than most places? Are we better? Are we about the average? I mean, how many cases a year would you say, you know, kind of come through your...
So when I started, the number of interviews that we did the first year were 17.
Okay.
The highest number of interviews that I've done, which was 2 years ago, was 52.
Oh,
so my God. It's not that child abuse has risen so mm-hmm. much, I don't think. I think that because people are aware of the services that right. are there and now available to help with those cases, I think the right. community partners are using us more. Last year, we interviewed 46 children. However, because we coordinate our county's multidisciplinary team, we touch other cases as well. Mm-hmm. We just don't count them in the Carly's Law exams and the forensic interviews. We're mm-hmm. looking at a new way to track those as well. We do have to report to the state for our child abuse multidisciplinary intervention fund money that we get as far as the kids that were and the cases that were dealt with at multidisciplinary team and the disposition of those cases, whether it was founded, unfounded, whether it was a family member, a non-family member, whether it went to trial, was it an acquittal, was it a non-guilty? So we have to track all of those. And so right now we have around 80 children in foster care in our county. And the cases that we see from time to time, or not time to time, the cases that are touched by the multidisciplinary team are under 200. So one year it can be 170 cases, another year it can be 140 cases. So we touch a lot of cases. Mm-hmm. We don't see all those children. Mm-hmm. The other thing that we're doing at Wally's house is there is a program called Fearsome Clinic. And that is a type of clinic that is run to bring the children that are in the care of the state, that are foster children, to one location to get the required screenings. Within 60 days of a child coming into foster care, they have to have a health screening, they have to have a dental screening, and they have to also go through a mental health screening and another type of screening done by a mental health specialist that helps determine a child's level of care requirement. Mm-hmm. And so we have been cooperating with Advanced Health and with the creators of the Fearsome Clinic that started in Coos County to bring all those kids to one place. When you become a foster parent, it's very trying to all of a sudden you're adding another body or two or four to your own home and routine.
Right.
And you're taking on addressing all of those children's needs. And if you're a parent of a few other children of your own, you're trying to get your kids to where they need to be, and you're trying to get these kids clothes,
right,
get them registered in school if they're being placed in a different school district. You've got all of these requirements that you have to meet. So if you have to chase around to all these different locations, again, to try and get these children's needs met,
right,
you're going to miss a matrix. Yes. And there are certain, yes, you know, the state, your insurance companies, your CCOs from the Oregon Health Authority all have to meet their matrix. And this just assists them in doing that and getting the children's needs met. And so we started doing that not long after we opened the doors of Wally's House. Our board was approached. So we do that as well.
Excellent.
And we're hoping to, in the near future, take that over and coordinate it ourselves. But right now it's being coordinated with DHS and Advanced Health.
So do a lot of the kids do they end up in foster care? I mean, what's kind of a typical,
there's no typical case. The children that come into care, a lot of times it's because, you know, one or both parents are not protective. Our county, just like across the nation, is dealing with substance abuse. So you have parents who are seeking drugs and using drugs, and the children are unfed, and the house is not in any way, shape, or form friendly to a child.
Right.
The state has been under a lot of scrutiny and in the way that they handle cases over the past few years. And so they're working very hard to make sure that they are handling the cases appropriately and removing children appropriately.
Mm-hmm.
And we are there to assist them in that. Mm-hmm. We are not there to tell them how to do their job. We are only there to help them assess a case and determine whether it's appropriate or not,
right,
based on what the child says.
Right.
I've had kids come in to the interview and they won't talk,
mm-hmm,
about what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
They're too afraid to be removed from an environment, even if it's not ideal and it is abusive. They're afraid of being removed because
better the
devil,
the
you
monster
know,
you yeah. know, than yeah, exactly,
than the one you don't.
Yeah.
So, but we have some really caring, loving foster parents,
mm-hmm,
that bring those kids through the home, and they do a great job. I know that the system and the people that work within our child welfare system are always in need of foster parents.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in our county, we have a program called Every Child, and that program is just, within the last year, has really been getting up off the ground and rolling, and they support the DHS workers, the foster parents, and the foster children, and they provide a lot of great supports. I mean, they take pizza to the DHS workers. They,
mm-hmm,
you know, they provide a night out for foster parents. We have a lot of grandparents that are raising their grandchildren too.
So. I know. I know several instances myself. Yeah.
So every
and
child,
I gotta say, as a grandparent, that's not a job I would want.
No, yeah. I don't look. Look forward to being a grandparent, not a parent.
Yes.
So I can really feel for
and
those
you just
people.
Don't have the energy that you had at one point. You know,
I mean, that's what they tell me.
Well, I'm here to tell you, you get to be 70 years old, and it's like, oh my goodness, I got to chase a toddler around. I'm in trouble. Yeah. So. How's your, you've got a full board or, I mean, how is the organization? You got enough volunteers, you got enough board members, you need donations. I mean, what's the overall?
So we have a capacity on our board for 13. Don't know where mm-hmm. that number came from.
Goodness.
13
me.
Members.
13, yes.
People say, oh, that's a huge board. But when you are trying to get funds raised and do mm-hmm. fundraisers, you need a lot of hands on deck.
Absolutely.
We, like I said, we are at a capacity of 12 right now. So we have room for another board member. Mm-hmm. I have stressed and worked hard to make sure that people in the county that I talk to about our program understand that this is not Gold Beach's program, because I've had people say, where are you located? Oh, we're on 8th Street in Gold Beach. Oh, you're in Gold Beach. Yes, we serve all of Curry County.
Mm-hmm.
We are the county's child abuse intervention
right,
center.
Right.
So,
well, Gold Beach is in the center of
it,
the.
It makes yeah. it very, you know, it, right. easy to access from all ends of
right.
the county.
Right.
And, you know, that's where the property was purchased mm-hmm. and remodeled mm-hmm. and provided to us.
Yep.
So it's, you know, yep, it's exactly. very nice to be able to be. It's easy for, you know, if the DA has to come, it's mm-hmm. it's in close proximity to him. We've had cases where we have juveniles that are the offender of other children. And so it's nice for the juvenile department to be able to come and
yep.
observe also if it's going to be a case that they're going to have to act on
right.
potentially. So right. we have a very active event committee that is being led by one of our board members. We have a couple more board members that serve on it as well. And then the one board member was able to recruit a bunch of ladies that she'd had coffee with, and they have just taken off with it.
Great.
So we work on events to raise money. We've done the Charitree. We've done last February we did a Valentine's dance. This year our event will be in the fall. We're looking at September or October, and we're going to do a kind of a country-themed dance and barbecue.
So it with your 501c3 status now, you'll be able to write grants, right?
We are completely grant-funded at this point.
Wonderful.
So we have grants from the state. The Child Abuse Multidisciplinary Intervention Fund pays for part of it. Victims of Crime Act money, which is federal money, but it comes through the state, pays for part of it. Mm-hmm. We've had a grant from Oregon Community Foundation, Oregon, let's see, Oregon Community Foundation, Collins Foundation. We've received small grants from Coquille Tribe, Wild Rivers. We've had a small one at around Christmas time a couple of years ago. The Oregon Health Curry Health Foundation mm-hmm. has granted us money for upgrades on things or purchases of equipment. We recently, in the last year, brought on a type of electronic record. So it's kind of like your electronic health records,
mm-hmm.
only it's completely created to do the retention of advocacy center records.
Right.
So it works with law enforcement records, your forensic interview, your advocacy piece of it, your DHS piece of it.
Great.
And your medical piece.
Right.
So Curry Health Foundation helped us with the purchase of that first year
Great.
Of it. We had money for the initial purchase, but then needed a year's support until I could get it written into my CAMI grant.
Mm-hmm.
I'm working on a Ford family grant right mm-hmm. now, and I So the I told you we record our interviews. We have a piece of equipment called an iRecord. That was purchased back in 2008. I upgraded it in 2014, and we are due for a brand new system. The computer system that it's on cannot be upgraded to Windows 10. If I tried to upgrade it to Windows 10, it would crash.
I know the problem, yes.
So Humboldt Area Foundation has a grant process. Great. I applied, and they granted us the $12,000 we needed to get that equipment. Wonderful. So we've made our deposit on it, and now we're waiting to take delivery and installation of the new equipment. AllCare gave us a grant several years ago that purchased a very specialized camera for photographing children's injuries, and that's in our medical clinic. It's called a Cortex Flow, and her name is Corey. Corey is their friend and takes their pictures.
That's great. And what about volunteers? Do you have enough volunteers? Do you need volunteers? What's your
vocal? Yeah. We need volunteers. We've had a volunteer coordinator that was volunteer, and she has moved away.
Mm-hmm.
So
volunteers do that. Mm-hmm. Yes, it's true.
And she recruited and led a team of people who come through the building every 2 weeks or so and clean the building for us in the evenings.
Nice.
So we haven't had to pay for building upkeep.
Great.
Now, this couple that she recruited are also looking to move out of the area. So we're looking to try and fill that.
Mm-hmm.
My volunteer coordinator also got trained and was presenting our Darkness to Light program. And so that piece we're trying to figure out how to do that.
And the Darkness to Light is a program that is aimed at adults.
It is aimed at educating adults on how to intervene and identify child abuse.
That seems to me like a huge piece of the puzzle.
It's evidence-based. It's been supported and by the Ford Family Foundation in a huge way. Mm-hmm. We actually have been cooperating and working with the Kids Hope Center in Coos County, and their grant is going to run out, so we're looking at ways to try and keep that going so that we can get into schools, churches, other areas. We've had, there is a program that Darkness to Light offers that is, you get special recognition and stuff if your whole staff is trained in that program.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the biggest things we've done through the years is trying to teach kids how to protect themselves. And it's not a kid's responsibility to keep themselves safe.
No.
As adults, we need to be keeping a sharp eye out.
Yeah.
I like to reinforce with people who bring their child, grandchild, or niece and nephew around me and say, oh, give her a hug. And it's like, if the child doesn't want to give me a hug, they don't have to give me a hug. It needs to be impulsive. It needs to be on their terms. And I think too many times we've forced kids to allow people contact with them because we trust that person and think that person is fine.
Right.
It just, if a child isn't ready to be involved with that person.
Or doesn't want that physical contact. I mean, the kids have reasons for why they don't want physical contact with somebody. They don't like the smell of the person. I mean, there's all kinds of reasons, and to force that on a child seems just really silly.
Right.
Not good, not smart, yeah.
No, and it just sets the child up for if they don't want to do it, but they've been forced to do it.
Yep.
If someone who really has bad intentions wants to break the rules as far as touching, then that child doesn't know that they can say no.
No, exactly.
So that's something else that we do at Wally's house is I have a video that I show it every year to Safety City, and it's called I Am the Boss of My Body. We also have coloring books that I've given out to school counselors.
Great.
And so we have that prevention piece, and we want to build that up and beef that up also.
Good.
I just want to make sure that I tell people here some of the groups in our community that have been helpful in supporting us with funds, with donations of snacks, juices. Little 8-ounce bottles of water are great too. But we've had the Brookings Emblem Club has supplied us with quilts and donations. Rotary and all the towns have supported us in one way or another. The Soroptimists in Gold Beach and Brookings have been supportive in either individual members donating or putting together snack purchases, toys, that type of stuff. Mentor Oregon put together backpacks. So I have these great little backpacks that when a kid comes after we've gone through the whole process, if they, you know, need a backpack, there's a backpack, but it's got goodies in it. The 4-H Archery Club decided to adopt us last year. Mm-hmm. And they took the list that we had on our website and donated an item off of it every month. So one month we got toilet paper and paper products. Another month we got Play-Doh.
It's great. So it's great. Jackie, I hate to tell you this.
Are we near the end?
We are so close to the end, yes. I can give you like another minute to wrap it up, but then we've got to go.
Well,
have a website.
I do have a website.
Might want to let us know what that website is.
So www.wallyshouse.org. People can make donations on there. They can also purchase our coupon book that we are doing as a fundraiser. It's $25 for a book of coupons that is good all over the county. There's different, each section of it has businesses from, different parts mm-hmm. of the county.
And there's a lot of information on your website.
We've got a great website.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
So other people
and the other interview that you did with Connie Hunter is up on the website. So that would also be a really good thing for people to listen to if they want more information.
So can we attach this? Will this be a podcast?
It will definitely be podcast. And that was actually one of the things that I'm going to say in my closing. Is if people have missed part of this, they can go to our website, kciw.org, and either listen to the podcast that's on the website, or they can look at the schedule, which is also on our website, that will tell when they can listen to the interview again. But we will definitely make sure that they have a way to get to your website. Well, if they listen to the podcast, they will definitely. And I'm sure we can, yes. My tech guy is shaking his head, yes, that we can work that out. So we will. So I just really want to thank you for being on the show, Jackie. It's great information, and I'm just thrilled that you're doing what you're doing.
Well, thank you for the invitation.
Well, thank you, and I hope you keep us updated. And I want to thank you for listening. I've been chatting with Jacqueline Antunes, the Executive Director of Wally's House. If you missed part of this interview, go to our website, kciw.org, and download the podcast. Or check our schedule on the website for other airings of this show, Our Community. This is Candace Michelle.